And when you get done here today listening to Cecil, you'll walk away feeling much better. So get up here, see?
First of all, I'd like to tell you that a friend of mine, name of Jack Sennon, is speaking at Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada, this afternoon. You don't know Jack Sennon, and you don't know where Dana, Saskatchewan, Canada is. That really doesn't matter. But he promised me if I'd mention his name down here, he'd mention mine up there. Well, I tell you what, I must say that I'm a little bit disillusioned about Apache. When Otto called me and asked me to come here, I had visions of Apache. I don't know Oklahoma at all. And I had visions of Apache. Well, been much larger than Oklahoma City. And I must say that Otto, as a public relations man, is wasting his time in a small town. And I don't know what I'm going to tell my group when I get home. Because I just went on Otto's enthusiasm when I explained to them about this big place that I was going to. But I'm going to say this now, that I don't care whether Apache is big or small, that this conference this weekend has been one of the greatest. I think that I've met everybody here, and I think that I've been blessed with a lot of good AA, a lot of good Al-Anon, and a lot of sharing and caring because of the size and because of the closeness and because of having to sleep in the same room as Jack and Ray. And I believe in closeness, but this is ridiculous. And I believe in sharing and caring, and I believe in loving. But sometimes they ask a man to go just a little too far. But ever since I arrived and attended a meeting down at Lawton, and was privileged to spend a lot of time with a lot of people, and although I've kidded Jack a lot on the weekend, Jack started this conference off in the right way. And I must pay tribute to his chairman, because I think his chairman did a good job too. And Ray informed me at 3:00 this morning. The speakers were a dime a dozen, but chairman were hard to find. And I'm a veteran that I get a pension from the Canadian people for my war effort. I'm a bottle-scarred veteran of the Atlantic Ocean. And I get a pension. And when I listened to that Wilson yesterday, every time I go to hospital, I get 100% pension. And he almost had me on 100% pension yesterday. He was just great. And you know, I have been in many, many places in the United States. And I've heard of Ramona. And I visualize this gal just exactly like she is. And last night, listening to her, It was beautiful. And I was privileged to win a blanket at the powwow. And she said something about what her mother told her. And I'm not a big mouth. But I know that some of you saw Ramona in my blanket. And that doctor came by this morning, who is a dentist. I have a brother that's a dentist. And I'm a little bit frightened. I just hope that this isn't one of the qualifications of being a successful dentist. Because he's doing pretty well. But he left me with a lot. He left me with a lot because he has a sense of humor that's the greatest. But he also has a message that I can take away from here. And I think that sometimes when we go to these conferences, that we expect a little bit too much from the speakers. You know, speakers are just human beings that just happen to have maybe the ability to communicate with other people. And after listening to all of these speakers, and I know if you got as much from them as I did, there's not too much left for any speaker to say. We could leave right now and we could have a successful conference. But I know that Otto paid the freight down here. And he wants me to say something. But I hope you don't expect too much. And it reminds me of a story. It doesn't really remind me of a story. I intended to tell it all along. About a guy, a little Jewish fellow, that was sitting in a bar. And his friend Charlie walked in and he said, "What is the matter, Jaime? You look a little bit upset." And he said, "Well, I should be." And he said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, 2 months ago my uncle died and left me $80,000. And Charlie said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear that." He said, "That's not all. Last month my aunt died and left me $20,000. Charlie said, "Well, I'm real sorry to hear it." But he said, "Look at Jaime. They have died. They were probably quite old. And at least they left you some money." He said, "You have $100,000. It's not a total loss. So why so glum?" He said, "This month, nothing yet." So I think that sometimes we expect too much. And I've been impressed by your chairman. But Ray, who I've already mentioned, that sweet little Millie who was unfortunate enough to get married to an attorney, and Ray, and I was privileged to have breakfast with them when they arrived Saturday morning, along with little Karen. And Karen is a girl that is very, very dear to me. Because her and I, we shared a program in Canada one time, about 13 months ago. And this was about 600 miles from my hometown, and about 1,700 miles from Odessa, Texas. And we became very great friends. And it was really beautiful to see her here this weekend. I don't know what to say about Hoot. Hoot met me at the plane one time when I was going to Brownwood. And he's about the most mixed-up Texan I've ever seen. Beautiful animal ran across the road. And it was a mink, and Hoot called it a coon. I said, Hoot, there's no such a thing as a coon. They're all minks. And, of course, George, this afternoon, who's your chairman, and I think that chairmen are very, very important people. And sometimes we overlook it. I'm going to tell a story this afternoon simply because I want to just tell something about myself. And not only that, I understand that there's a fellow down in this area. I think he's from Apache, and I think his name is Otto. And he was at a group the other night, and he told a story. And somebody said to him, that damn Canadian stole your story. And I just want you to know that I've been telling this story since before Hoot even knew there was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just want to get this story straight. That he stole it from me. Otto stole it from me. And I haven't got any resentment about it. I'm just mad. And the reason I tell the story is because as I go around, I heard a lot of people say, who is the Canadian speaker? And back home, I'm pretty well known. And when old Cease is at any conference, they know who I am. And if they don't, I tell them. And the story is about a dear old lady that bought a parrot. And she bought this parrot, and she took it home, and she paid a lot of money for it. Now, this is the way the story's supposed to be told. I mean, I know that Otto has told it, but he hasn't told it. She took this parrot home, and she found out, after paying all this money, that the parrot couldn't talk. And she taught this parrot to say three words. And those three words were, who is it? And all day long, the parrot would go around, who is it? Who is it? Who is it? And the old lady used to get a little upset, but she was quite proud of herself, the fact that she had taught the parrot these three words. And one day she went downtown, she left the parrot home by herself. While she was downtown, a knock came to the door, and the parrot says, who is it? The voice came back and says, it's the plumber. The parrot says, who is it? And he says, it's the plumber. Parrot says, who is it? And the voice came back and he said, it's the plumber. P-L-U-M-B-E-R, plumber. Parrot says, who is it? And the old plumber, he wasn't one of the fellowship. And he completely lost his serenity. And he said, look it. You told me this was an emergency. And you told me that I had to be here today. I told you I couldn't come till tomorrow, and you insisted, and now I'm here. I'm a busy man. Now open the door and let me in so I get the job done. Parrot says, who is it? And the old plumber, he got so uptight that he just fainted dead away. And he's laying there in front of the door. And the old lady comes home. And she looks down at him, and she said, who is it? And out of the house comes a voice, it's the plumber! So I'm not the plumber. But I'm your Canadian speaker, and I guess I better get on with it. Now, I understand that there's a few people here that have heard me speak before. And there's a few people who have said some unkind things to me. But, you know, after you grow a bit in Alcoholics Anonymous, you learn to accept these things. And you learn not to say unkind things back, you know. You grin and say a little prayer for them. And hope that one day they will grow, too. And that, too, reminds me of a story. Story about a couple of psychiatrists. One was a great big one, the other was a little one. And he used to get in the same elevator every morning. And every morning, the big psychiatrist got off on the third floor and the little psychiatrist got off on the fourth floor. But every morning when the big psychiatrist got off on the third floor, he spit on the little psychiatrist. And finally, after about a month, the elevator boy couldn't stand it any longer. And he said to the little psychiatrist, why does that big psychiatrist, that big fella, spit on you every morning? And the little psychiatrist says, that's his problem. And I don't know whether there's a message there or not, Jack. But that's the way it is. I've learned another thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was a deep blow. I've learned that everybody doesn't like me in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. But I also learned one thing, is that I have to like each and every one of you. Not only that, I have to love you. And this has been wonderful. Because you have meant so much to me. And this weekend you have meant even more to me because I needed you. And I'm leaving from here and I'm going to Dallas. I'm going to Florida. I'm going to Monroe, Louisiana. And I'll be with people like you for the next week. And then back to Canada. And it's a pretty wonderful thing for me to be in Apache, Oklahoma. And it's a pretty wonderful thing for me to be invited back, to be invited back to Dallas, to be invited back to Louisiana, because I've been there before. And I say that because I remember the day that I was never invited the first time. And today I've been invited back to places because of you people. I used to go to many places I wasn't invited to the first time. And I used to speak. Loud and clear. But I certainly didn't receive any of the love from my speeches in those days that I receive today. As I told you, my name is Cease, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be here. And I can't say what you people say about, because of this wonderful fellowship and the grace of God and you people, and I don't know what all it is. You say it so fast, I just can't follow. Even in the deep south, they say that fast. And down there, not only do they talk slow, they hear slow. And then you go on and say, because you haven't had to have a drink or a sedating pill or something like that, whatever the hell that is, It's on such and such a date. But I'll tell you later on, because it takes longer for me to tell what I want to tell about when I sobered up. I came to this fellowship when I was 27 years of age. And I mention that because I know there are some young people in the crowd. And if anybody ever says to you that you came too soon, just mention to them that maybe they came too late. Because I didn't come too soon, believe me. My drinking career didn't last very long. Thank God for that. It lasted 11 years. I came from a very good home. I came from a very poor home. I came from a very spiritual home. I was a very good athlete. And I realize today that the reason I was a very good athlete was because I wanted to be wanted so much. And this is before I ever had a drink. I went into the service when I was 16 years of age. And I didn't go into the service because I was a big hero. I went into the service because I had started to run away from responsibility. I ran from the discipline of my home. I ran from the discipline of my school. And I ran from the discipline of my church. And to show you that I was much smarter than most teenagers today, I ran away from discipline and I ran into the army. And I would suggest if any of you teenagers that are here and you're trying to run away from discipline, try that because it helps a little bit. And I tell that story because that's where I started. Because that first day, that first night that I was in the service, I went downtown with all of the rest of the men. And I had my first drink, and it was beer. And I had several beers. And a wonderful thing happened to me. I became somebody that I always wanted to be. I became so that I could converse with anybody about anything. Longer and better than anybody in the crowd. I became the best dancer that night at that dance. Canada's own Fred Astaire, there I was. And it was beautiful. And if you think that Apache is small, you should see the little town that I came from. It was small, believe me, it was small. And I went into this larger city where I live today to join the army. And I was a scared little boy. And that night, everything was great because I had something to make it great. And the next morning, I was once again that scared little boy that had come in from this small little town to join the army. But I had found an answer to my problem. And that answer was booze. And I was a beer drinker for many, many years. And I became any kind of a drinker. It didn't matter. And I can't understand people today that talk about certain brands. I just don't understand this. Because it never did matter to me. And I don't think if the truth were known at 2 o'clock in the morning, it really matters to you. As long as it gave me that desired effect, I was happy. And I didn't stop to look at what brand it was or what it was. I just wanted to get that effect. And I wanted it because I needed it. Because I wanted to be somebody I wasn't. And that's what liquor did for me. I was very successful in the service. I became an instructor shortly after I joined the service. I got kicked out of the service shortly after I joined the service. I went back home and I worked for a little while, and I didn't like the responsibility that I got in this job, and I joined the service again. I told them I'd never been in before, and I was a genius. And I became an instructor immediately. And I got kicked out shortly after that. I went back home and I told everybody how I'd been recommended for my commission, how I'd have been the youngest officer in the Canadian Army if I hadn't got discharged. I got another job, I made too much money, and I got too much responsibility, and I ran once again, and I ran back into the service. And this time I ran into the Navy. They didn't know I'd ever been in before. And I was once again a pretty smart boy. I went through officer's training in the Canadian Navy. And I'd love to stand here and tell you that I was an officer in the Canadian Navy, because I wanted to be. But it seems that the officer that was in charge of officer's training didn't appreciate me telling him what to do with the ship. And when I was at Miami, Florida last year, the international conference, I looked out at one of those big ships, and by God, it was a physical impossibility what I told him to do with that ship. But I didn't get kicked out of the Navy, I just got kicked out of officer's training. I stayed in the Navy until the war was over. I was in many places with your boys, because I was down in the South Pacific a lot. And this was a big thing for me, because there were very few Canadians in the South Pacific. And this was a real big thing for me when I used to go home on leaves and tell them that I was in the South Pacific, because there weren't too many of the boys could sit around and tell lies like me about the South Pacific, because they'd never been there. But all of the time I was drinking to be somebody else. And I hated responsibility. I took on some responsibility when I was in the Navy. I got married. And I wished I could tell you that I led that little gal a good life, but I didn't. I came back from the service, and I celebrated the end of the war. I celebrated the beginning of the Korean War. I started getting jobs. I started losing jobs. And I started down that road of alcoholism. And I became a high-class bum, so I thought. And there's not much difference between a low-class bum and a high-class bum, believe me. I was blessed with two little gals, my wife and I were. And I tell you that because there's a story about those two little girls that I have to tell. I can remember when I was 25 years of age, I went to my first AA meeting. I wasn't taken by anybody that particular day. I had lost my business. I had lost my wife, and she'd taken our two little girls and left me. And I can remember standing in this little town about the size of Apache, and a fellow coming along and saying, "Do you want a ride, Cease?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "It doesn't matter." And that's the way I felt. And I was only 25 years of age. And that night I went to my first AA meeting. And I tell you this story because I hope you never do this to some young member when he comes in. For that night, they told the stories of their drinking. And that night, I wasn't trying to find out how in the hell to drink, believe me. I was trying to find out how to stop. And these dear old people, and I know they were doing what they were supposed to be doing to keep themselves sober. But they told stories about drinking that I had never heard of. They told about jails. And they told about mental hospitals. And all they did was really tell me that I had about 15 years to go on the bottle. And thank God I only lasted for two more years. The last 2 years that I drank, I became a fighter. I had 17 fights, 17 knockouts, and I lost them all. And I wasn't fighting in big rings or anything. I was just fighting wherever somebody wanted to fight. And I tell the story about fighting because that's what brought me to you people. For you see, the last night that I drank, I was a big gambler. And I lost a lot of money, and it wasn't mine. And there was a big fella that was 265 pounds, and he looked like about 118. And he got a little narrow about the fact that I had run out of money. And he said some unkind things to me, and I told him to stand up, and he stood up, and I looked down at him. And he hit me, and I hit the floor. And I got up, and he hit me, and I hit the floor again. And finally, after several times, I didn't get up. And I tell you that story because I hope I never forget it, because you see, that night, in the city that I live today, where I am a respected citizen, the people that I rub shoulders with today were at that particular party. But they left me laying on that old cement floor, and they stepped over me because I was a drunken bum. And the next day I went to hospital. And thank God the doctor that put me in hospital knew a little bit about me, and he knew a little bit about alcoholism. Because he told me that there was nothing he could do for me after I'd been in hospital for 5 days. He had built me up physically, he said, and that's all he could do for me. And I said, well, what should I do? And he said, well, Cease, as far as I'm concerned, you're an alcoholic. And he said, I would suggest that you join Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't leave it at that. He sent these people to see me in that hospital. And he sent up two guys that I knew. And one of them was the sloppiest drunk in all of Canada. And I had drank with him. And he came up that night. And I tell this because this is so important. When they tell us that we are based on attraction rather than promotion. Because when this guy came to see me, a sloppy drunk, he came to see me and he was dressed up. He had a beautiful brown suit on. He had brown shoes on. He had a bow tie and a white silk shirt. And his hair was combed and he was clean. And he didn't have to talk because I knew that something had happened to him. The other fellow was a chap that I'd been in the service with. And when he'd come back from overseas, he'd got in some trouble in Edmonton, Alberta, which is west of us. And he got 5 years in a penitentiary for robbery with violence. And he found Alcoholics Anonymous in a penitentiary. And people wonder today why I am so interested in institutional AA. I am because when Earl came that night, I knew what had happened to Earl and I could see there was a change in him. Earl is not sober today, but Bill is still sober. And it really doesn't matter whether Earl is sober or not. It would be nice if he was. But he did what he was supposed to do at that particular time. He tried to carry the message. And he did. I went out of that hospital. I went downtown. And at that time, our group was about the same size as the Apache group. And they had an emergency meeting. And they got in this little old cafe. And I wished you could have seen me that morning. Because I love to dress up. I've always loved nice clothes. I've always had nice clothes. Today I buy them and pay for them. One time I didn't. But that morning, all of the buttons were off of my shirt. I was beaten up. I was black and blue. I was sitting there in that cold morning. It was January the 16th, 1952. I had my collar up on my overcoat so that they couldn't see my suit and my shirt. And they sat down and had a meeting with me. And this, too, is important because I couldn't believe that people could care that much. That they would leave their work and that they would come and sit down and talk to me. And that they wouldn't ask me a bunch of ridiculous questions, but only, "Cease, if you want to stop drinking, we have an answer for you." And they took me home. And that was probably the longest trip that I've ever had in my life. That trip from that cafe to my home. Because I'd been away for several days. And I was going home strictly sober. And I was scared of what that little gal was going to say. For you see, she had come back to me. She'd only been away a month when she left me. And she'd come back. Because I talked her into coming back. Because I told her I was going to stop drinking, and I did for 4 days. But you beautiful Al-Anon people had been up to see her. And when I walked in, she said, "I think everything is going to be okay." And I couldn't believe it. Because that's not the way that I was usually greeted. Because my wife was a little bit narrow when I stayed away for a week. She just couldn't take a joke. That night I went to my first AA meeting. The club rooms was right on our main street, upstairs. And I looked around to make sure that nobody was watching, and I ducked in. And they had a social. And it was a lot of fun for some people. It wasn't for me. Because they played stupid games. Like pin the tail on the donkey. You know. On a Saturday night, can you imagine? And really and truly, I thought that some of them had been drinking. I even sniffed a few of them. Because I said, there's no way they can act this way on a Saturday night. After the social, they had a meeting. And about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, I don't know what time it was, a couple of them took me into the next room and they said, "Cease, There are no musts in Alcoholics Anonymous. But they said, tomorrow morning, there's a meeting at 8 o'clock, and you must be here. And I'm glad they talked to me like that. For you see, that's the only language that I understood. I wouldn't have, if they had soft-pedaled this thing to me, I would have probably gone along the old way that I always did things. And I think it's important that we tell people at this particular time what they have to do. I think there's a bunch of garbage where we say, easy does it. This really is. When we say that, whether we're in Al-Anon, Alateen, or Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe that we are killing people. We should tell them the truth, because when are we more receptive than when we are sick and looking for an answer? And it's up to us, and I don't think we're having any problems today getting people to Alcoholics Anonymous, to Al-Anon, or to Alateen. Our big problem is keeping them here. And I think that's what we should look at. And that reminds me of a story. Story of a guy that worked for a big company, 300 people. And the company said that they would give them a pension plan if everybody signed it. 299 people signed it. The 300th guy, he didn't sign it. President of the company went down to see him, and he said, I don't believe in that insurance. Go ahead and give it to them. He said, if I die, he said, I'd die, and I'm not leaving money for some other man to marry my wife and spend it. President of the union went down to see him, talked to him. He said, look, go ahead. The other 299 people are happy. I don't want no part of it. The shop steward went down to see him. The superintendent of the company begged him to take this policy. All he had to do was sign it. And he said, no. Finally, the assistant superintendent went down and he said, look, 3 seconds after I finish explaining this to you, if you haven't signed it, 2 seconds later, you will be out that door and you won't walk out. I will throw you out. The man took the paper and signed it. He walked back up, handed it to the 4 guys that had been down there begging before. They rushed back down and they said to the guy, how come you signed it? And he said, nobody ever explained it that clearly before. And I think that's a responsibility that we have. Explain the thing clearly. And I had a great time in Alcoholics Anonymous those first couple of years. I was the youngest member in the group. I was the youngest member in the province of Saskatchewan. Everywhere I went, and I'm talking about age, everywhere I went, they patted me on the back. Nice to see you, young fella. Oh, boy, it was great. I broke my anonymity to anybody that would listen, especially bank managers and finance companies. Told them what a horrible man I was, and look what's happened. And I had a great time. And then something awful happened to me. Just a horrible thing. All of a sudden, some younger people came into that group. And you know what they did? They walked right by Cecil, and they went up and talked to those old geezers. And you know what those older people did? They walked right by Cecil and went down and talked to these young people. And how do you feel? I tell you how I felt. I felt like the hole in the donut. I was nothing. I was a middle member. And that's the toughest place to be in this fellowship. I mean, how do you feel if the young members don't talk to you and the old members don't talk to you? And you're probably the only middle member. And I believe if we're losing people in Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, or Alateen, it's the middle member that we're losing. So don't let people become middle members. give them something to do and talk to them. Because I almost went out and got drunk at you. And I felt like it. But then a wonderful thing happened. A fellow by the name of Ernie. And Ernie's now gone. He died of a heart attack. Ernie had had a lot of trouble with this program. And we asked him to be chairman. And he says, well, I'll tell you what, I'll be chairman if you will let me do what I want to do. And we said, what do you want to do? And he said, well, I want to go through these steps in sequence, starting at 1 right to 12. And he said, I don't care who comes into our group. And at that time, the Prime Minister of Canada was from our town. And his name was John Diefenbaker. And he said, I don't care if old John Diefenbaker comes in. We are not going back to step one. We're going to start through these steps and we're going to go through them. And we wanted to humor Ernie and we wanted him to be chairman, so we said, okay. And he said, not only that, he said, we're going to do them. The whole group, he said. And we kind of snickered, you know. But old Ern was serious. And we started to go through those steps. And thank God for Ernie. Because Ernie told me that I didn't have to be a middle member, that I didn't have to be an old member, that I didn't have to be a new member. I found out that I could be just one of us by going through those steps in sequence. And I took a look at myself in step one, where it says we admitted we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. I found out in that book all about alcoholism. I found out everything that I was supposed to read in the book about alcoholism. And I also found out that there was a second part to that first step, and it was the fact that my life had become unmanageable. And I found out that not only drunk but sober, that I had an unmanageable life. I had come to this program owing $6,200 in 1952. And if you want to put that into inflationary method, that's a lot of money. And I just owed it. Not for a Chesterfield, a chair, a car, or a house. I just owed it. And that's not easy to look at. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. We started going through these steps. And I started looking at things. And I found out that I had a very unmanageable life because of money. And I found out that financial problems had nothing to do with money. It had a lot to do with big shotism. It had a lot to do with ego. It had a lot to do with pride. But it really had nothing to do with money. And you may say, well, give me $10,000 and I'll show you that I'll pay them off. For you see, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was working for a man that had a lot of money. I was a good employee. And he took me to the bank, and he signed a note, and he made me sign a paper for himself that I would never charge anything again. He wasn't an alcoholic. He was a very, very smart Jewish businessman. And he knew a lot about money, but not much about alcoholics. A few years later, he bailed me out for $7,500. For you see, I couldn't go into a store and buy something for $369, supposing it was Chesterfield. I would stand there in my big shotism way and say, haven't you got something for seven? You know? I couldn't go into a store. And if I owed them $300, I couldn't pay them $30. I wanted to pay them $300. I had too much pride. And I found out that I had an unmanageable life in many, many other departments. Now, I know this is ridiculous telling you people about this, because you probably none of you have this problem. From Oklahoma and Texas and got lots of money. You know, financial problems. A few defects of character, but no financial problems. But back in Canada, we run into this. And I went on to that beautiful second step where it says, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And we did this step. And I couldn't believe because I had never been to a mental hospital, and I thought, well, how can I come back from somewhere I'd never been? Because I figured that if you were insane, you had to go to a mental hospital. And then they took me aside once again, and they said, cease, think of your negative thinking. Think of your insane thoughts. And we know that you will realize that you are an insane person. And to show you how insane I really was, I can remember one time going to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which is 100 miles away from my town. I went there for an interview for a big job. I never ever got a small job, instead. It's always a big one. And this biggest hotel in Saskatoon where the appointment was the Besborough Hotel. I didn't go to the Besborough Hotel. I went to the Empire Hotel. I got drunk for 3 days. I didn't have the interview. I went back to Prince Albert. And my wife said, how did the interview go? And I said, good. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I had to say something, didn't I? And she said, well, what happened? And I said, well, I just have to wait for a letter. Now, there's really nothing wrong with that because she was making conversation and I wanted to communicate. But when you go to the mailbox every morning looking for the letter, I would suggest that maybe, just maybe, I was a little insane. And when I'm talking about negative thinking, I like to tell a story about negative thinking. Story about a fellow who was going on a holiday. And he went into a barber and he said, I'd like a haircut to last me for 3 weeks. And the guy said, why 3 weeks? And he said, well, I'm going on a holiday. And the barber said, where are you going? And he said, first of all, I'm going to London, England. And he said, you're not going to London, England. He said, I am. And he said, you're not. And he said, I am. He said, no, I don't know. I've never been there. He said, but he said, I hear that London, England is a horrible place to go. Too many people, too many cars. He said, it's just no place for a tourist to go. Now, I don't know. He said, I've never been there. He said, but this is what I heard. The guy said, look, I don't care. If I don't like it there, I'm going over to Paris. The guy said, you're not going to Paris. And he said, I am. And he said, you're not. And he said, I am. And he said, I don't know. He said, I've never been there either. He said, right here, it's just a horrible place. He said, they want the tourist money. And he said, they just really fleece you. And he said, as I say, I've never been there, but he says, I've heard this is the way it is. And the guy said, look, I don't care either. If I don't like it there, I'm going on to Rome. And he said, you're not going to Rome. And he said, I am. And he said, you're not. And he said, I am. And he said, I don't know, he said, but he said, I heard that these people over there, just horrible people, those Catholics, he says, you really got to watch them. The guy said, look, I don't care. I'm a Catholic. He said, yeah, but they get a different kind of a Catholic over there. And he said, look, just cut my hair and let me go. He said, I want to go on this trip. So the guy went on a trip. 3 weeks later, he comes back, slides into the barber chair. The guy says, how was the trip? And he says, great. He says, it wasn't. He said, it was. He said, it wasn't. And he said, you didn't go to London. He said, I did. He said, you didn't. He says, I did. He said, it wasn't nice. And he said, it was. And he said, it wasn't. He said, it was. And he said, as a matter of fact, he said, I'd love to have stayed there a little longer. But he said, I want to get on to Paris. And he says, you didn't go to Paris. And he says, I did. And he says, you didn't. And he says, I did. And he said, how'd they treat you? And he said, great. And he says, they didn't. And he says, they did. And he said, as a matter of fact, he said, they like the tourist money, but they give you value. And he said, I'd love to have stayed there a little longer. He said, but I wanted to get on to Rome. And he says, you didn't go to Rome. And he says, I did. And he says, you didn't. And he says, I did. And he said, well, what happened over there? He said, well, how'd those Catholics treat you? And he says, really great. And he says, they didn't. And he says, they did. He said, as a matter of fact, a wonderful thing happened. He said, I got an audition with the Pope. And he says, you didn't. And he says, I did. And he said, you know, a real funny thing happened. He says, you know, he says, I knelt down. He said, to kiss the Pope's ring. And he says, you know what the Pope said? And he said, what? And he says, where the hell did you get that lousy haircut?